Hi there, I'm Sam Hawley, host of ABC News Daily. Our podcast covers one big news story each weekday in just 15 minutes. From history-changing world news to cost-of-living concerns at home, expert guests and ABC journalists explain what matters most. We cover breaking news and the big challenges of our time. Follow the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham Dunton, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, who is getting help in Venezuela and who isn't?
So these are ordinary people from Caracas, local communities and across Venezuela that are looking for people with their bare hands. When I was at this site with this collapsed house, people were telling me, look around, there is nobody here with heavy machinery. There is no one helping us. But if you go down the road where somebody more important lives, you know, there is.
We're going to hear from a journalist in Caracas who's been speaking to communities crying out for assistance, people that need heavy machinery to dig their loved ones out from the rubble, while more intensive efforts are being focused elsewhere. It's a really fascinating real-time insight as people are still being rescued alive. Then we'll turn back home because the Minister for Communications and Sport will be here right as the government introduces its legislation for gambling ad restrictions. We'll also return to the Aged Care Minister for an update on a controversial algorithm-assisted tool. All that is coming up from the Radio National Breakfast team on The Breakfast Wrap. So it has now been a week since the twin earthquakes in Venezuela struck, and the desperate search for survivors actually still continues. In the last day, we've heard of people still being pulled from the rubble alive. Yet, more than 2,200 people have now died, and there are still some 50,000 people believed to be missing. As we're about to hear, in Venezuela, there is this growing sense of outrage at how the government is responding to this crisis. There are some communities accusing authorities of neglecting them, leaving them to dig through the rubble, searching for their loved ones with their bare hands. Our international producer, Pip Cook, tracked down journalist Catherine Ellis. She's in Caracas, and she's been reporting on this situation, hearing stories just like this. And just to add to some of the difficulty on the ground, Mel Clark had to navigate a pretty tricky phone line. So apologies in advance for some of the crackle, but you're still able to hear what Catherine tells us about these continuing rescue efforts and who is and isn't getting the help that they need.
Caracas was hit, obviously, by the earthquake, but the actual worst of the damage is just north of Caracas, about 40 minutes north. And there it's like a war zone. It's a complete disaster. Now, I've been a few times in the last few days, and there have been literally people sifting through the rubble, trying to find people that they still know are trapped there. It has changed. It's been a week now. So, you know, we do see international rescue teams, but it has mainly been people without masks, without helmets. And people have become quite frustrated and quite angry, especially when they see military in the street that are just standing around or just directing traffic, basically. So there is a lot of frustration.
Yeah, can you explain that for me a bit more? What is the lack of involvement here from the Venezuelan government? Is it that they don't have the resources? Is it how the resources are being deployed? Explain it for me a little more if you can.
I think it's a little bit of everything. I think they didn't expect something like this, which many people are angry about. Of course, you cannot predict an earthquake. We don't know that's going to happen. But Venezuela has been hit by earthquakes before. It's been hit by disasters before. In 1999, there were mudslides that had killed thousands of people. So they're very, very frustrated at the lack of preparedness for this and also the lack of response. A lot of people on the ground are just saying they just haven't done enough. It's been too late. And now when you actually are in La Guaira, unfortunately, you know that there are dead bodies around because unfortunately you can smell them.
It's just horrendous, impossible to imagine from the other side of the world of what that must be like. But can you explain to me when people are making these efforts to try and search for relatives or friends and family by themselves without machinery? Because we hear that there are some places where there's heavy machinery, but it can't be used because there's not enough fuel. Is that something you've seen?
That's something I've seen on social media, and there are places that are running out of, that yesterday there were a couple that I saw that had run out of fuel. I'm not sure about today, but yeah, the heavy machinery, one, there's not enough heavy machinery to go round. Heavy machinery can't always be used if they think there's still survivors in there as well. So that's another issue. But what people are most annoyed about is that there's not, you know, the actual military and actual people from the Venezuelan state aren't doing enough to actually go through the rubble themselves. It's ordinary people. Another guy that I met yesterday had come from another city and said, you know, I have three daughters. I'd hate to think that they were just lying there injured and no one was looking for them. So these are ordinary people from Caracas, local communities and across Venezuela that are looking for people with their bare hands.
And there have been some reports of preferential treatment, that some of the machinery and resources have been funneled towards wealthy people who've got the capacity to pay for it. Again, is that something you've seen any evidence of?
That's something I've heard. So yesterday, actually, when I was at this site with this collapsed house, people were telling me, look around, there is nobody here with heavy machinery. There is no one helping us. But if you go down the road where somebody more important lives, you know, there is. There's heavy machinery. There are people helping. So that is certainly something that people are feeling here. I mean, apart from that, I mean, I tweeted about it the other day, even the treatment towards the international press. You know, normally we don't get in very easily. You have to have a special visa, but they're letting us in at the minute. You know, there was a spread laid out the other day with nice food, even little fans keeping flies off the food. Hadn't been invited to that. They weren't given the buses we were given to get to La Guaira. So there's a big difference between, you know, how ordinary Venezuelans are actually being treated to either international teams and then people who have high-ranking families.
And that is journalist Catherine Ellis there. She was calling in to Radio National Breakfast this morning from Caracas in Venezuela. And you'll be able to hear coverage of this tomorrow and also next week on Radio National Breakfast. Right, so the federal government is expected to introduce its gambling ad legislation to Parliament today, but it's already facing calls for amendments and a Senate inquiry. Now, if you missed yesterday's wrap episode, we heard from the Coalition and the Greens about their concerns. You can find it on ABC Listen. But today we heard from the federal government. Annika Wells is the Minister for Communications. She's also the Minister for Sport. And here is what Mel asked her first.
How far advanced are you in your conversations with the Coalition and the Greens and others in Parliament about the prospects of it passing?
Look, this is something that has been debated for a long time. In fact, the Coalition and the Greens have obviously talked about they'd like to see action sooner. The legislation's finally ready. It's been through the exposure draft process, so I guess everybody's had a chance to weigh in on that. We'll introduce it today. And like I said earlier this week, it is usually the case that these things go off to a Senate inquiry. It's usually the case that members of the House of Reps will make amendments, and we would expect that to happen from today.
How willing are you to make further changes to meet the demands of, say, the Greens? We had Sarah Hanson-Young on the program yesterday saying that this bill doesn't tackle things like the inducements that are made to people who are known to have gambling problems, that it doesn't deal with issues like having a proper national regulator. Are you willing to make changes to address those concerns?
Well, we do genuinely believe we have addressed the issue of inducements with BetStop. There's obviously always more we can do in social policy. The pen is never down. But I guess we will always consider in good faith amendments that are put forward by any parliamentarian, either in the House or in the Senate.
I doubt that's going to satisfy the Greens. It may not satisfy the Coalition. Have you had productive discussions with the Coalition about their position?
Yes, of course, we talked to the Coalition about this alongside the Greens, alongside the crossbench.
There's been some reporting in the Financial Review this morning suggesting that the bill will prevent former athletes and other prominent people from promoting gambling on podcasts or social media. Is that right?
That's right. One of the things we wanted to do with this package of reforms is address the influence of influencers in this space. But at the heart of the package, which is really significant reform, is trying to remove the insidious effect of gambling advertising on children where they experience it incidentally. So that's at the heart of the package.
Yet children can still be exposed if they are watching matches at time frames. On television, we will still see some gambling advertising in certain hours. Children might very reasonably want to see a full game and be up after 8:30. So if that is the objective, if that is the core of the bill, why does it not go further to make sure kids do not have exposure to ads if they are watching major sporting events, regardless of the time of day?
Well, there is the ability for you to not have your child see that no matter what time of day they're watching, which is the triple lock function, watching any of these programs through a streamer. So we know that free-to-air has to have major events through our anti-siphoning laws, but if you chose to watch, I don't want to name any particular given that we're on the ABC, but you know, if you are watching the Football World Cup on SBS, another public broadcaster, for example, you have the ability to opt out of seeing gambling advertising. And from
on
1 January...
if you are streaming.
On streaming. And we know the trend for viewing in Australia is that more than half of the population now view these things online through streamers, and that is how, as technology evolves, households will continue to evolve. So we've set this law as a way to phase out, but knowing that's where we're going. So ultimately, if you don't want your child to see advertising, you will have the ability to lock it out completely.
Well, that assumes that you have access to streaming. And as you say, that might be where the trend is going.
That's
but
right.
A lot of people rely on free-to-air television and analogue television services, and that doesn't apply in this circumstance.
Well, we've still capped it at 3 ads per hour. And like I said, we would like this delivered implemented 1 January, because we understand people have waited a long time, people care deeply about this issue. Every delay to this, be it said inquiry, be it any other shenanigans that might go on, a good faith Senate inquiry or any other political hijinks. I'm thinking of the social media shenanigans that the Coalition have put forward.
We'll come to that
yesterday.
In a minute. But
there are deeply entrenched views in this issue. That is why it has been so difficult to land a package that is workable for everybody. We put at risk the 1 January implementation by any form of delay.
I find it interesting you say there's deeply entrenched views when there was ability to get consensus with the Murphy report. Part of the reason it was so extraordinary was because it did manage to get consensus across the political spectrum for its reforms, yet you haven't gone as far as that. Is it really as hard to go further, as you suggest?
Well, in some cases, we have gone further than the You Win Some, You Lose More report. For example, they spoke to restrictions on pocket pokies. We are banning them completely. We've also gone further in some of the lotteries, both overseas lotteries and some of the dodgy lottery operators that operate in Australia. Those three pieces of work go further than what You Win Some, You Lose More recommended.
Annika Wells there, the Minister for Communications and Sport, right as the government introduces its legislation on gambling ad restrictions. All right, if you get confused listening to this next interview, don't worry, you're not alone. So stick with it, because it's a really interesting insight into how the federal government is acting on calls to fix a problem and how it's trying to explain just what it's doing. A few weeks ago, we did an interview with the government's aged care minister, and it got a huge response on our text line, but it also followed up on calls from the public for change and clarity. So here it is, kind of. The federal government has announced there will be changes to its controversial algorithm-assisted tool, which it uses to determine how much funding older Australians will get to support them living at home. It's called the Integrated Assessment Tool, and since it was introduced last year, the government has received hundreds of complaints about the application process, prompting an urgent review. Now, last time when he was on, the aged care minister, Sam Ray, defended the tool. Today, he came on to discuss what changes the government was making. And Mel tried to unpack just how those changes would work.
So can you talk me through the problem that you're trying to fix here?
Well, we're trying to fix the aged care system, Mel. There was a Royal Commission, as everyone knows now, uncovered terrible, terrible things, horrific stories. And since we were elected in 2022, the Prime Minister's made very clear that this would be a key focus of our government. And we've worked tirelessly ever since that point to build an aged care system that older Australians can rely upon. Now, the assessment process for accessing care is a key component of that. And along with that came the integrated assessment tool. And that has been something that we've been very clear about all the way through would require ongoing refinement. We've already made significant refinements. This is the latest refinement. This is about making sure that when there are a small number of people for whom the tool doesn't neatly capture their needs, there's an option, an escalation option, where the secretary of the department can make the necessary decisions to get them the care they need.
So the frustration for a lot of people had been that there was this assessment tool that assessors came, worked
person to person with someone, plugged the information in to check it against the assessment criteria, and that process was automated and there wasn't a way to challenge that. So you're saying there will now be a pathway for people to challenge that assessment that is made through that automated process?
There's a bit of misunderstanding about this, Mel, so just if I could
please clear it up.
Yeah, thank you. So we rely on highly qualified assessors, human assessors, just to be clear, to do all of the clinical assessments for older people. And that's usually done in an older person's home, often with a support person in place as well. That clinical data is collected. It's entered into the integrated assessment tool, the IAT. There's then an automated component, which is the application of the aged care rules. And this is where the confusion starts to lie. Once that process happens, it goes to a second human being, the assessor delegate, who then has to sign off on that. And if the older person is unhappy or a supporter of the older person is unhappy, they've got the option to refer that to a review process.
So you're saying that the person within the system, not the family members, who would raise that?
Well, older people and their family members already have this option to seek a review, and that will, of course,
Through the administrative review tribunal?
No, that would be, that'd be separate, way down the line. No. Yep.
How do you trigger that additional clinical assessment?
Well, that's subject to some of the conversations we want to have over this winter break, Mel. We want to engage in good faith. A lot of the work that we've...
So we don't know...
Well, I'll tell you my view in just a second. But I also want to be clear. I want to remain open-minded about some of these things. I want to hear from more people. I want to hear from assessment organisations. I want to hear from supporters. So we're going to have...
I thought you had been hearing from them. I mean, you've been getting a lot of complaints about this process.
Oh, I've been hearing.
But we don't have an answer yet. You're saying there'll be an additional clinical step, but you're not how that's triggered is not clear. Like, do the families get to trigger that? Is that only people within the system who are looking? Is it certain conditions that trigger it?
My view, Mel, subject to the discussions, as I said, I want to engage in good faith, but my view on this is that it'll be the assessment organisations, that they will lean on their clinical judgment to understand where in a very small number of cases, the tool doesn't neatly capture the needs of a particular complex set of conditions, for example, the assessment organisation will lean on their clinical judgment and they'll be able to initiate this escalation pathway.
So is that a clinician in one of the assessing organisations being a human overriding the automated assessment against the objective criteria? Is this the human making a different conclusion from what the automated process would have otherwise come to.
Oh, sorry to be pedantic.
No, please do. This is clearly very detailed, and I think the steps are not entirely clear.
Yeah, that's really fair, Mel. And it's a complex system and we've tried to simplify it. Nevertheless, the assessment is not an automated thing. The assessor, highly trained clinical assessors, always humans, they conduct the clinical assessment. The automated component is the application of the rules, and they have to be the same for everyone. That's how we get fairness and consistency in the system. And of course, it's how we brought wait times down.
That's the automated process, right?
That's the automated process.
Yes. So is this the bit that there will be another clinical point at which there can be an intervention?
Yeah, at that point, where the assessor organisation, the clinical assessor, essentially, or the delegate is probably more appropriate in my view, where the clinical assessor delegate makes a decision that that process hasn't neatly captured the needs of a complex set of conditions where the tool doesn't capture that. We're talking about outliers here. Of the 206...
So does that happen before the tool assesses the information? Or does the assessment tool be used and then that clinical assessor delegate then looks at the outcome and then steps in?
That's right, Mel. The latter of those two. So the clinical assessment occurs, the aged care rules are applied against that clinical data, and then the assessor delegate would look at that and say, well, the clinical assessment inputs are right, they're satisfied with that, but they don't think that the framework is addressing that person's needs. So they can then initiate the escalation pathway to allow some discretion to be applied by the system governor, who is the secretary of the department.
Now, you're saying this would only be in a few cases, but you're also not clear or haven't settled yet on what would be the triggers for it. So I don't know how you can say it could only be a few if you're not even saying what it might be that would assess that, because a clinical assessor delegate might see a lot of cases where they think this system isn't appropriate for the complexity and the specifics of this case.
That's a fair point, Mel, but we can also model what the likeliness of this is. We've also, it must be said, we've done 260,000 assessments between September and March, 260,000 in a 6 month period. And of those, only 0.5% sought review. Now, some of those reviews were related to the clinical assessment itself. Some of them were related to this issue that we're raising today, where the tool doesn't neatly capture the needs of the person. So from that data set, we can extrapolate a likely number of cases where this is where the appropriate pathway.
How long is that likely to take, given many of these assessments are really time sensitive?
At their worst, people were waiting 10 months to get an aged care assessment. The median wait time is now consistently under a month. We want people to get assessed regularly as their needs change.
But is this an additional step that is going to mean that for some people in those complex or unusual circumstances, their cases take a little bit longer?
That's true. And we will be seeking to make sure
That's not great.
We'll be seeking to make sure that that process happens as quickly as possible. The current review process is 90 days, but my view is that it would be done by the assessor delegate organisation and that'd be rapidly completed because it'll be a relatively small number of cases overall.
What about people who have been through this process in the meantime? Is there an ability to go back if there are people who think they are one of these complex or unusual cases that haven't been able to have the opportunity of this clinical assessor delegate reviewing it a second time? Will they have the ability? Will there be a retrospective element to this at all?
What we've built is an assessment organisation where people no longer have to wait for excessive periods of time to be assessed. We want people to be assessed regularly. So
you think if there's an issue, they need to be reassessed again?
And that's what we want. We want people to be reassessed regularly so that their care attribution meets their needs.
And that is the aged care minister, Sam Ray, there. So if that was tricky to follow along with, don't worry, plenty of people will think the same. Here's what Mel asked our political correspondent, Tom Crowley, right afterwards.
Could you follow the change that the government is making here?
I think so. I mean, can I say, I think it's actually really good to get into that level of granular detail, and it's a good insight into a part of the policy process that we don't often see. And I think it's fair to say that both politicians and media not always great at the follow-up and the implementation and of course there's an element of spin when Sam Ray says, oh, we always said that there would be refinements. This is clearly something that didn't work as intended and that they've needed to go back to the drawing board on. But equally, it is correct to say this is a really significant change to the aged care system overall. The government has basically redesigned everything almost from the ground up, particularly for in-home care. And the Greens and the Coalition and the Parliament, in a sense, doing its job in forcing them to grapple quickly with issues that are raised by people in the aged care sector that maybe the government might otherwise have taken its time to fix or not fixed. You know, we don't know, but that's parliamentary scrutiny, in a sense, working as it should. What this automated tool has been doing, as Sam Ray says, is just sort of applying in a very programmatic way the eligibility rules following a clinical assessment and all the details about your income and all the other things that go into the aged care assessment that are either put into the form by you or by the clinical assessor. What is now going to be created, and we sort of got there to the understanding of this by the end of the interview, is that after that automated system makes its judgment, the clinical assessor will have another opportunity to say, is this a complex person who has been unfairly dealt with by the standard application of the rules and where we need to go back to the drawing board? We've seen some of those stories. The government had a specific carve-out for people with motor neurone disease, but there was a story about, you know, someone with really advanced MND who did not get assessed for the highest level, and everyone looks at that and says, well, clearly they should be. So this is what the clinicians will then have the opportunity to do. But as you say, then there's the risk that for the most complex people, that slows down the assessment process. So it's not an easy problem to fix. And as you say, it sounds like there are a lot more details that the minister still intends to work out and doesn't have clear answers to yet. So it's one that's worth following.
And that is Tom Crowley. Hopefully that all makes a bit more sense now. I'm glad we were able to get through that story because it's probably one we're going to come back to as well. Thank you so much for listening to all of those interviews from Mel Clark. They were produced by the Radio National Breakfast team, helping us navigate some of the detail in those really tricky stories. Eddie Diamond produced the Breakfast Wrap, and I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll be back in your ears for the last show of the week tomorrow.